Town Judiciary, Tuesday, April 7th, 2009 at 5 p.m. First item on the agenda is Senate Bill 356.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 356 comes to you from the Committee on Judiciary, and it relates to civil forfeitures, clarifies that Oregon's forfeiture laws and incorporates changes in the laws to reflect the enactment of ballot measure 53, reenacts Oregon's forfeiture law, redefines forfeiture proceeds. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is as a result of the initiative that was passed last fall, last May. And one other thing it does, it re-codifies and repasses all of Oregon's forfeiture laws, so there's no question concerning its constitutionality.
Okay, thank you. Robin Bovet and Michelle Burrows, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can the council confirm we had a committee vote of, what, 10 to 1 and floor vote of 30 to 0? 10.
Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, it was a committee. That's, yes, that is the...
So, committee? 10-0 in committee? And.
I don't know how we get 10 on the the Senate side and the floor vote of 30.
10 is a big committee.
That's double the number on the Senate side. But the vote is correct as far as the yeas go. Bonamici, Bonquist, Dingfeld, Wissett, and Prozanski, they all voted yes. They voted twice that time.
Representative, you double the size of the office.
That's right. So square feet. They get two votes.
Yeah, it has to do with, yeah, exactly.
The brain matter, there's twice as much there. Chair Barker, representatives, thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 356. I would be happy and delighted to give you the long and tortured history of Oregon civil forfeiture.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Rob Bovet, Lincoln County District Attorney.
Thank you.
The short story is as counsel mentioned, this is really the implementing legislation for ballot measure 53. It is the result of essentially the deal we all struck as a consensus in 2005 and then the subsequent passage of ballot measure 53. As counsel mentioned, it does recodify all of ORS chapter 475A and makes only the necessary changes to that statutory scheme to implement ballot measure 53 and essentially the deal we struck in 2005. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have relating to the bill. I was a civil forfeiture practitioner for 16 years until taking office as the district attorney, so I have a bit of experience in this area of the law. So if you want to get into the finer points of civil forfeiture law, I'm happy to, but I suspect you may not want me to do that.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Burrows.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, Mr. Chair. I'm Michelle Burrows. I'm an attorney in Portland. I represent Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With Mr. Bovet, we have worked on forfeitures for at least 10 or 12 years together. This is not my first time testifying on a forfeiture bill, but I will assure your Mr. Chair and Penny that this is a consensus-driven rewrite of forfeiture statutes. We all agree on it. We're all very friendly with each other. We like this bill, and we're presenting it to you as a consensus package.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? And just for especially the newer people on the committee, I'd like to point out that Representative Olson did a lot of work getting this out over the last few years, in fact. Okay, thank you very much.
Kudos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 356A.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, I move to the House floor Senate Bill 356.
Yes. Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 356A to the floor to do pass.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Excused.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Excused.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Steeler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lisnett.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Also, will you carry that for us?
Mr. Chair, that was a lot easier than the first time around.
Yeah.
It took months.
Good reason.
And open a public hearing on House Bill 2802.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2802 comes from the Committee on Judiciary, repeals the $500,000 limit on non-economic damage, recoverable and wrongful death actions, and other statutorily graded causes of action.
Call first panel, Stephen Hendricks, Carol Wiley and Lori Hughes.
She's a sponsor of the bill.
And Marianne.
She's sick.
Yeah, Marianne Alameda, please, as well.
I think she went out to try to get a hold of Steve.
Okay. We'll have Marianne open, if you wouldn't mind.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marianne Almeida. I come before you today as legislative aide to Representative Tina Kotek from House District 44 North and Northeast of Portland. I'd like to read her testimony today. She is unfortunately out sick, and I thank you for being understanding and accepting her testimony secondhand for me. And so, from Representative Kotek.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today before House Bill 2802.
This bill would repeal the $500,000 limit on non-economic damages recoverable in wrongful death actions and other statutorily created causes of action. This bill was introduced by this committee at my request on behalf of one of my constituents, who first contacted me during the interim with his frustration with the legal system following the death of his wife from complications of lung surgery. He felt that her treatment was medically negligent, to be very generous, but was unable to find a qualified attorney to take his case. I am strongly in favor of this bill, and I hope that you will join me in supporting the rights of the families of victims of wrongful death. The most common causes of wrongful death claims are car and truck accidents, motorcycle crashes, drunk drivers, medical malpractice, aviation accidents, defective products, construction defects, and intentional assaults. In each of these situations, it is imperative that we allow the victims' families to seek just compensation for their loss. Not only the economic loss in medical bills or lost future wages, but the pain, emotional distress, and loss of companionship accompanying the death of a loved one. The negligence contributing to the wrongful death should also be punished, and we must be sure that there is a real cost to this level of irresponsibility. Furthermore, removing the statutory cap on non-economic damages and wrongful death claims put the power back in the hands of juries across the state. Last February, for example, the Oregon Supreme Court cut in half the damages awarded during a trial by jury to a Lane County mother, who I believe is here today, whose 19-year-old daughter died of bacterial meningococcal infection after diagnostic and prescriptive negligence at the Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, simply because the statute prevented the level of damages that the jury had chosen to award. The current law avoids the power of juries to deliberate and reach a fair judgment and should be amended to return the control over determining the amount of damages awarded to the appropriate actors, the juries of peers constitutionally charged with this responsibility. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill. Please join me in empowering our citizens to find the help and justice they seek should the tragedy of the death of a loved one occur. Thank you, and I'd be open to questions or please contact our cousin.
Any questions?
Thank you very much. You did a good job on reading that.
My name is Lori Hughes, and I am bereaved of my one and only child, Jill Marie Derringer, who died February 9th, 2001, at Sacred Heart Medical Center. My daughter went into the hospital at 3:30 in the morning, and her vital signs indicated to me, at the time I had a two-year degree, that she was in shock. Her heart rate was incredibly fast. Her breathing rate was incredibly fast. Her blood pressure started to fall and continued to fall. The emergency room doctor wanted to administer antibiotics and wanted her hospitalized. But she didn't have the authority to hospitalize her, so the hospitalist said no. She decided that my daughter had mono. I don't know if you've ever noticed that there are commercials on TV saying this is a preventable disease. My daughter was vaccinated, and the vaccine does not work for the strain that my daughter had, Neisseria meningitidis, also called meningococcal disease, sub-zero group B. The reason the vaccine doesn't work is because it imitates the disease imitates the human brain cell, not exactly what you want to turn your immune system on. This is actually part of the court record. This was prepared by the attorneys. My daughter was in systemic inflammatory response syndrome, otherwise known as SIRS, the acronym, and her continued, everything just deteriorated, and they didn't do anything about providing care except overloading her with fluids until she pointed out to them that she had spots. She had been at the hospital for 9 hours with spots. I didn't go down there immediately because I was told my daughter had mono and that she was leaving the hospital as we spoke, and I was supposed to make sure that she came home to get bed rest. And then, I did get there, but I got there late, and my daughter was not recognizable from the amount of fluids that they put in her. If you were to make a person drink the amount of fluids that they put in, that person would have a very high probability of dying. They told me in the intensive care unit that there was no way that they could have known that my daughter was so sick and that she needed help and that there was nothing that they could have done. Well, I found out otherwise. There were four doctors that testified on my daughter's behalf. It was an ordeal for me to go through a wrongful death trial. I know the doctors did not appreciate going through a wrongful death trial, but it was necessary because they never made any kind of an offer. They seem to think that there is no such thing as accountability. And so then my case, because the jury doesn't know that there is a limit, my case went to the appellate court, and then it got bumped up to the Supreme Court. There were two justices, Justice Walter and Justice Durham, that dissented. They wrote eloquent dissents. I think that the Supreme Court essentially is saying that the legislature enacted this, and the legislature needs to fix it. I am here to humbly ask you to please don't let somebody else suffer like this. I wake up every day knowing that my daughter could be alive and that she's dead because antibiotics are now something that are used more commonly in agriculture than they are to save a human life. And so do you have any questions for me?
Thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry to go through this again. It can't be pleasant, but it's important for us to see real people here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, I do have a question. Mrs. Houston, thanks for sharing your testimony. I'm just curious, I mean, since this occurred with your daughter and everything, have you thought of where, should there be a cap at all, or should there, I mean, be a cap? I mean, I'm sure this is just, you've wrestled up and down with this.
I don't believe that there should be a cap. Okay. The jury in my daughter's case awarded $1 million. And I am not going to sit here and say that, how do you put a value on a person's life in something like that? They picked what they felt was fair and reasonable, and I accepted that. And I just feel that the cap undermines the legal system, and ultimately, this thing's 22 years old. You're going to make it to where people won't be able to have access to law,
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't mean you personally. I mean caps in general. Okay? Caps in general. I mean, it's a nationwide thing happening. It's a very nationwide thing, and it's to the benefit of privileged. I'm one person. I don't have the means to lobby to further my causes.
Thank you.
My name is Carol Wiley. I'm from Milwaukee, Oregon. I want to thank Chair Barker and the committee for allowing to give me this opportunity. Tell you why I believe this cap should be removed. In August of 2003, my husband was referred to a hematology oncologist to find out why he was so anemic. This hematology oncologist checked him, said, "I don't see anything. But we're going to run a bone marrow study." She set him up for a bone marrow study, sent our family doctor a letter saying that she's going to do the bone marrow study and an ultrasound of his kidneys. Well, the bone marrow study was done in her office. The ultrasound would have had to have been done at the hospital. and they dropped the ball. They didn't order the ultrasound. My husband didn't even know she wanted to do one. She treated him with a medication that cost $1,500 a shot, and it just didn't do any good. She treated him with that for over a year, and finally he went into her and he says, "It makes me feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. I don't want any more shots." And she, "Oh, well, just one more. It looks like your blood's improving." Well, over this whole year, it increased maybe 0.1%, the hemoglobin, which isn't much. Anyway, he asked me the next time he had an appointment to see her, he says, "Would you go in with me?" And he says, "Yeah." And he says, "She won't listen to me. I told her I don't want any more of those shots." And I says, "Well, I'll take a day off from work and I'll go in with you." Well, since someone was there with him, when he says, "I don't want any more shots," she says, "Oh, okay." So he went back to our family doctor to see if he could find out what was going on. He just kept telling me, "I wish they could find out what's wrong." And when he went back to our family doctor, he looked through his records, and he says, "I don't see a copy of the ultrasound." And he says, "There was someone done." So he referred him to the hospital the next day to have an ultrasound. And at that time, the one kidney, his right kidney, was almost totally engulfed with cancer. It had grown in there for over a year. They took him into the hospital and they took the kidney out. And he was on dialysis then. And then we got him changed over to home dialysis, which he really enjoyed because he was able to do things during the day. He was hooked up to the machine every night, but he was able to do things during the day. And then in August of 06, his dialysis fluid looked cloudy, so we took him and the fluid down to the kidney dialysis center downtown Portland, and they looked at it and they says, "Yeah, you've got to go to the hospital." So they transferred him, sent him up to St. Vincent's Hospital first, and they didn't have any beds and they didn't have the facilities to do dialysis there, so they transferred him into Portland Providence, which is where he had the kidney removed at. And that was in October 3rd. October 5th. And he was in the hospital for 4 days, was discharged. And the next morning we woke up and his voice was real slurred and he stammered and everything. And I called the doctor. I says, "Sounds like he's had a stroke." So she says, "Take him right back up to the hospital. Tell them I said for him to be admitted." I took him up there. They took him in. They found tumors in his brain. He was in there for a week. Came back home. And he was home for almost a week, and then he was just vomiting continuously. I mean, part of it was totally processed food. I mean, everything just kept coming back up. And finally he asked me to take him back to the hospital. I took him back on the 25th of October, and the doctor called me that Saturday to let me know that they finally found out what his problem was. And he told me he was full of cancer. When they opened him up and took the kidney out, some of the cells had a chance to escape. in the kidney, since the kidney sends stuff through the body, it just spread every place. And I asked the doctor at the time, I says, how long do we have? And he says, anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. And all this time he'd been working, running our business. He was a locksmith, and we monitor burglar alarms and medical alarms. And anyway, he got a chance, and the doctor told me that. He says he wants to talk to the kids. We have 2 boys and 2 girls. So I called them and told them, and we all went up to the hospital, and he talked to each one individually. And that night, the nurse asked me if I was going to spend the night there. I said, well, I hadn't planned on it. She says, I think you should. So I ran home. I got a few things to keep me busy that night. And I got back to the hospital. I was there maybe half an hour, and he passed away. That was the day after the doctor said he had 2 to 4 weeks. He took all of the information regarding our company with him. I didn't even know how to run the billings. And I think this cap should be removed so others don't have to go through the same thing. I mean, no two cases are alike.
Thank you. That's a very moving testimony. We really appreciate you coming in and giving that testimony. And you see how difficult it is. And we're sorry you have to go through this again every time it comes up. But thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I speak for just a moment?
Yes, please.
Chair Barker, hi. My name is Stephen Hendricks. I am an attorney, former president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I had the privilege of representing Cheryl Wiley and having an opportunity to meet her and her family. Her story is unfortunately too typical. There is an unfairness in Oregon law, and the unfairness was eliminated in 1967 when this body decided that you could not cap the value of human life. But in 1987, the legislature saw fit to put a cap back on all injury claims. The Supreme Court declared injury claims constitutional, but that because a wrongful death claim is a creature of statute, it was permissible to put a cap on the value of life in a wrongful death claim. So we're asking you now to please go back to the way the law was previous to 1987. Allow Oregon juries to make common sense decisions on a case-by-case basis instead of an arbitrary one-cap-fits-all sort of solution. The cap has some very unusual consequences. I'm actually pursuing a case right now for another cancer victim who happens to still be alive, but he's stage 4, and it's very likely he'll die within 6 months to a year. And it's sad to say that it becomes to the benefit of someone who did wrong, someone that made a mistake they shouldn't have made, negligence, to delay that case, because if that case goes to trial when the person is alive, there's no cap. But if that person has died, then the cap applies. So you have this bizarre situation where delays are to the benefit of the defendant. In fact, in asbestos cases, I think we have some testimony from Tom Powers, a colleague of mine, where they were actually negotiating the settlement of a case as his client was dying. And had the other side gotten wind of the fact that his client had taken a turn for the worse, that could well have impacted the ability of that family to continue on. It's just an unfairness. And so we're asking you, and you see these two very strong women in front of you. There are many, many others. Oregon juries are very common sense groups of people. They do not do crazy things. They do not have outrageous amounts that they award. In another case, I was representing a fellow from Malala, and the jury decided that his son, who happened to be the person that did the computer system for the Oregon State Lottery, killed in a freeway accident. That case was worth $750,000 plus the amount he would make. But unfortunately, that gets cut back to the cap number, $500,000. So these are not outrageous amounts of money, but this cap has been in place for 22 years now. And this is an opportunity for you, we feel, to make the law more fair and more just. Thank you very much for giving us a hearing on this. I stand to answer any questions about procedure or the merits of this proposal.
Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you again. Thank you very much again for your testimony. It's very helpful. Holt and Chris Schultz.
Chris is in reserve. It's another committee at 6 o'clock, so I wasn't sure about the time. For the record, Tom Holt here on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. Coming around to you right now is our written testimony for the record, as well as the most recent Supreme Court case from Oregon at issue here, which was the case against Sacred Heart Medical Center, which I'll point out on about the fourth page gets into some of the history of the statute that I think is relevant today. One, I want to say at the outset that obviously no one can put a price on the loss of life. It just can't be done. But when it comes to litigation, it is good public policy to have a cap on the punitive damages for wrongful death. And indeed, with the exception of the interim that was just described, there has been a statute in Oregon on wrongful death nearly since the state's founding. The first statute, as the court points out, was adopted in the 1860s. There's the reason that it's good to have a cap in terms of public policy is really the fact that it is impossible to set a value, and so therefore it's appropriate for the state to make some determination of what is an amount big enough to be punitive but not so large as to be totally unpredictable and upset the balance in litigation. You've recently had before you Senate Bill 311, where in fact an effort was made to set some limitations in the context of actions against state entities. And the fiscal impacts around that issue, there were some numbers put on what the costs would be to the state were you not to take action. And that was estimated by OHSU to be in the range of $20 million just for one biennium. So I'm not going to attempt to extrapolate, because I can't, to what that means to the private sector, but I would imagine it's a fairly large number. Now, in a state where we are already short of many specialists in medicine, OBGYNs, closed head trauma surgeons, pick your high risk specialty, we are short of them. If we create unpredictability in damage awards based on what are inherently going to be awful facts of any given case, someone has died, the facts are going to be terrible. If you have an uncharismatic, unpopular defendant, those and high emotions in a case, those things can run together to create totally unpredictable awards. If those awards are unpredictable, they are then inherently uninsurable. And if they're uninsurable, that will devastate economics, especially of health care, which is already under severe stress. In other parts of the building, we're spending a great deal of time on healthcare reform precisely because of that.
So is $500,000 the right amount? Well, I wouldn't pretend to play Solomon. But what I would say is that absent a cap, we know some things will occur. There will be some cases that are hard cases where large awards would likely result. We know that it would probably change greatly the dynamics of any pretrial negotiations that would perhaps result in more just settlements. Should people be compensated? Absolutely. When there is a wrongful death, there should be compensation. There is compensation for all economic damages, all those things that are remotely quantifiable. It's appropriate in the state. It's public policy to retain a cap on the non-economic damages. That has been more state policy for most of the state's history, and we would suggest that it would be appropriate to leave a cap in place. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Mr. Holt, this cap in place or a cap in place?
Mr. Chair, I think that at the present time, we'd be willing to look at whether this is whether this needs to adjust with inflation or something like that. But given this economy and the costs that are happening, our preference obviously would be to leave it in place.
But rather than no cap, a cap would give some stability or some liability limits that would be at least.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a cap is absolutely essential.
Okay, I just try to get some information. I did,
Mr. Chair. Maybe you'd probably best ask Brian Behringer.
Okay. Brian Behringer, could you come up for a minute, please? If Mr. Hall, if you don't mind.
Not at all. Well, okay.
If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brian Behringer with Oregon Health and Science University. I believe the question is, what are the cap numbers in 311? They are for the state OHSU SAFE and others, $1.5 million per claim with an escalator to $2 million, $3 million per occurrence with an escalator to $4 million. In the local governments, it's $500,000 with an escalator to $666,700, and a per occurrence $1 million with an escalator to $1.333 million.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair. Okay, question. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian, are those non-economic damages or economic damages or total?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are, in 311, we eliminated the distinction between non-economic and economic, so those are total numbers.
So if somebody had economic damages of, in a state claim, of $1 million, then they would be limited to $500,000 on a non-economic claim. So the total right now is a $1.5 million based on Senate
correct.
Bill.
I believe that's correct.
Right. Thank you.
Question.
Do you know what the annual salaries of the highest paid OHSU employees are relative to the highest paid employees of an insurance company in the United States of America?
Is that directed to Tom or Beam?
You, I guess his answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the question is what are the highest salaries at OHSU?
Yeah. Yeah, I know the highest paid insurance officer probably makes a couple $1 million. What's the head of OHSU make?
From memory, I believe, I'm going to take a shot here. Maybe Susie is behind me and can make a noise if this is right. Is it 600?
Okay.
$700,000. $750,000.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, what's Smith? I didn't bring that file with me.
I'm just curious. I mean, if we're, and for the record, let me just say, Mr. Chair, if we're thinking about an argument that we should apply public sector limitations to the private sector, I think we should also be thinking about relative compensation levels and relative revenue levels. And let me say, I don't think they're in the ballpark.
Okay, thank you. Any further?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I think what we're talking about here is victims and their ability to recover for something that's occurred to them. And, I think we need to be careful when we say because I hit somebody and killed them, it's different than if somebody was in a state vehicle and hit them and killed them. It's still the victim that we're talking about here. And I think we're talking also about doctors who are trying to do public service in a private office or a private hospital, as well as doctors who are trying to do a public service in a state hospital doing the same procedures. So I think that's what I'm looking at, and that's what I'm seeing at, not different levels of compensation in different positions, but in actual same positions that we're talking about liability reform here.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Representative Stegler.
I have two questions. I'm always interested. It's the old, what's in a name? Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. I always like these names that are put together. Who is a member of, what's the coalition? Who belongs to the coalition?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, the coalition's fairly broad. It includes business organizations, professional associations, number of individual companies. I believe our list is out there. We can provide you with detailed information I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
If I started naming names, I would leave some out.
And just a question, two other things. First of all, wrongful death cases aren't just medical malpractice cases. I think, isn't that accurate?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, that's absolutely correct.
Right, and our wrongful death cap applies to any wrongful death situation that might occur.
Correct.
Okay. And then also, follow up. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Pardon me. I went beyond my two. Follow up. Thank you. In a situation where a person might be, we'll say, permanently injured or damaged, either in some kind of an accident or some kind of a medical operation or something, and that person survives, they wouldn't have this cap on their on any kind of liability that might result from that. And is that accurate?
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, and I want to speak with respect, because I know there's one of the issues that kind of really divide us, and we can sort of, and I'll try to modulate my own emotion level, knowing that we've got a lot of business to take care of and a lot of bills to work on, and I know we're going to have to agree to disagree on some of this stuff. I do want to respond to your well-stated comment, Representative Cameron, and say that I think that this bill, and none of the testimony I heard advancing this bill, has anything to do with predictability for victims, or rather, excuse me, not the bill, the existence of the cap. I don't think any of the testimony I heard from you had anything to do with offering predictability for victims. It had everything to do with predictability for economic enterprises. To me, the financial wherewithal of those economic enterprises and whether they are operated primarily for the good of the order, primarily for a combination of the good of the order, and maybe even more so for their own financial well-being, is intensely germane to how we should treat them if we're trying to provide them financial predictability. If you were here to testify on behalf of victims, my guess is there would be some slightly different testimony. And also, for the record, I think I heard you say that the healthcare crisis we're dealing with right now is related primarily to, maybe you didn't say primarily, but to malpractice. And if you did say that, I wanted to make sure I heard that correctly.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, I'll take your last question first. I don't think I meant to imply that our issues in healthcare are primarily driven by medical malpractice. However, it is a key issue, and it was identified by the Oregon Health Fund Board, I believe, in their report. So it is a very significant issue. As to the issue of predictability, I would argue that there is some benefit to plaintiffs in having the predictability of there being available a remedy. It may provide some incentive for settlements to occur quickly rather than perhaps creating an incentive to go to trial in search of a larger damage.
We can leave that to them.
Thanks. Representative Krieger.
In rural Oregon, because we're talking about malpractice and what might happen, we lost six of our eight doctors in Roseburg over the fact that the malpractice was going to be so high they had to move out. And in Curry County, it's almost that bad. And trying to get doctors to come in is bad because there is no predictability. I'll give you just a little example. $52,000 policy is on the low end of a malpractice policy. They'll go up into $100,000 or more, depending on what it is. But even to $52,000, it's $1,000 a week, $200 a day, or $25 an hour just to pay the malpractice. Well, who else is affected by that? Every insurance company, who pays the insurance? You and I and everyone out here eventually pays for it. Now, I have never heard, not once, from any doctor, from any attorney, from any private individual, and this has come up at a couple of town hall meetings I've had, and also at candidate forums, everybody wants to make sure those people who are actually harmed are taken care of. And it's the adequacy of that, and where is that line of justice? And if the justice is at one point for the state and it's a different point for somebody else, I don't think that's justice.
Thank you. Representative.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Tom, Brian, I've got a couple questions. First thing is that with the cap being at $500,000, and I'm just kind of throwing this out there to get a feel from you what you think. With the Clark decisions, Senate Bill 311, you know, Tom, you mentioned $1.5 million as a starting point. What would your thoughts be if we applied kind of a similar concept toward this that we're talking about right now, 2802?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, is your question how would we react to having a level playing field between the state and the rest of the world?
Yes.
I think Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I think Bill.
Chair members of the committee, Lakin and Clark are different.
I understand that.
I think what you would be talking not as it relates to all tort actions,
right,
but as it relates to wrongful death. I think that's the question, Mr. Holt. So how would you react to a higher tort limitation for wrongful death, something similar to what they have in Senate Bill 311? Is that it?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't get it.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I'd be hard-pressed to argue for anything other than a level playing field.
You know, and the other thing, follow up,
please.
I mean, I've been studying this for the last couple of years, well, last year and a half anyways, regarding the tort caps, and especially as it applies toward non-economic damages. The state of Texas implemented one about 4 years ago, and their tort cap was set at $250,000, but they have a two-tiered system similar to kind of what's going on right now with Senate Bill 311. You see anything at all like that working here? I mean, I think $250,000 is way too low.
Yeah.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I'm not familiar enough with the Texas statute to be able to speak to that with any authority. I think there's a number of ways that, you know, this issue could potentially be, you know, resolved. I think our bottom line is that we believe it's very important to preserve the public policy of having a cap.
Thank you, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to put my experience as business manager of a small primary care clinic out there for the committee's use and understanding. Because I write the checks for my wife's primary care clinic, I can tell you for primary care providers, the professional liability costs are much less than $52,000. I think we're paying under $3,000 a year. And while she's a family nurse practitioner, and it might not be apples to apples, my assumption is that for primary care providers, it would be significantly less, something, you know, maybe twice the $2,000 or $3,000 that she pays. But so that's one thing. And I think the other thing that we need to talk about is why do we end up in these situations to begin with, where you have someone in the emergency room getting rushed in, somebody has to make a snap judgment that probably should have been better taken care of in a primary care setting. And so, for example, in a regular fact of life is when my wife, who's getting maybe $35 a unit on the Oregon Health Plan, or maybe double that in the private world, is having to harangue about which antibiotic they should be able to give to a six-year-old, and after a couple of hours, whether it's dealing with the private insurer or with OHP, we end up giving them something that is not in the best interest of this child. And then at 2 in the morning, my wife gets the phone call and has to this five-year-old has to be rushed to the hospital because the proper medication had been denied. And then you are stuck with the emergency room doc having to make a snap judgment on something. And I think that type of medicine often results in these type of very large settlements as well. And I think, so I guess what I'm trying to say is it's complicated.
Thank you. Good point. I appreciate that perspective. Any further? So, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
it,
you.
Mr. Holt. Okay. And the bill, of course, is not ready to be worked today, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2802. And thank you for coming down to testify tonight. Meeting adjourned. Oh.